It is Friday, May the 25th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, President Trump calling off the summit with North Korea.
I was relieved, especially that it is happening now rather than to have it happen at the summit.
Irish abortion referendum up for a vote today.
The amendment has caused endless debate and trouble because of the wording of the amendment giving equal right to the life of the mother and the unborn. That, in practice, has been very problematic.
And also ahead, a centenarian runner plus the new World Cup theme. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says North Korea stopped taking part in bilateral consultations that would have been necessary for a productive summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. VOA's Michael Bowman reports that Pompeo, in testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, provided additional insight into Mr. Trump's decision to cancel the historic encounter.
Just moments after President Trump's letter to Kim Jong-un was made public, Secretary of State Pompeo placed blame for scrapping the summit squarely on Pyongyang.
I regret the statements that the North Koreans have made over the past few days and the fact that we've not been able to conduct the preparation between our two teams that would be necessary to have a chance for a successful summit.
Democratic Senator Bob Menendez said the administration should not have been surprised that North Korea is acting as North Korea often does in international negotiations, and that stumbling blocks were foreseeable.
Many of us were deeply concerned that the lack of deep preparation that is necessary before such a summit is even agreed to was not taking place. And now we see the consequences of that. And I'm not sure that constantly quoting the Libya model is the diplomatic way to try to get to the results that we seek in North Korea, because that didn't work out too well for Gaddafi.
By contrast, Republican Senator Cory Gardner spoke as though Kim, not Trump, had put the summit on hold.
I think Kim Jong-un has walked away from a historic opportunity for peace and should be held accountable for his decision. In the internal debate that must be taking place within Kim Jong-un's mind between Kim the propagandist and Kim the peacemaker, it's clear that Kim the propagandist prevailed internally and that the peace lost out to that propaganda.
Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen asked Pompeo what the administration will do next regarding North Korea. The Secretary of State replied, quote, situation normal, implying that the status quo remains. He added that the American-led pressure campaign on Pyongyang will continue. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
And the news about the Trump-Kim summit was welcomed by some analysts. Evans Revere is a senior director with the Albright-Stonebridge Group and says he's participated in numerous dialogues between both the North and South Korea. Revere told VOA Asia's Ira Melman via Skype that President Trump's cancellation may actually be good news.
Well, I must say, to be very frank with you, I was relieved. Especially that it is happening now rather than to have it happen at the summit, and the it being the recognition by the president and his administration that the North Koreans are not serious, or at least not serious at this point, about denuclearization.
Do you think there was a turning point here? Why do you think that this happened now? Is it the given idea about the harsh rhetoric over the past week or so?
I read the president's letter carefully, I would hope that the United States government and the president in particular are not reacting to a letter or to a pair of messages, rather, from two senior foreign ministry officials, the first vice minister for foreign affairs, and then just a few hours ago, the vice minister, both of whom I know quite well. I hope they didn't react to their statements as being statements from the lips or from the pen of Kim Jong-un, because they are not necessarily that. They're authoritative, they're official, but they don't necessarily reflect all of the thinking of the North Korean leadership. So there may have been something else communicated by the North Koreans in recent days through the channels that have been established that made it pretty clear that the North Koreans were either having cold feet or were prepared to come to the negotiating table and say and do things that were not acceptable to the United States.
What do you think it was?
It's hard to say, but I note with great interest that just a few hours ago, as I was waking up early this morning, I saw an interview carried on the CNN website with an unnamed senior administration official. And I have to paraphrase it. I don't have his exact or her exact words in front of me right now. But that senior U.S. administration official made it very clear that there was no agreement on the part of the North Korean leader to denuclearize, that Secretary Pompeo in his two visits and others in their visits and in the ongoing communications between Washington and Pyongyang had not received a firm commitment by the North Korean leader to denuclearize. The way that this official put it is that we are waiting to see if the North Korean leader will make a commitment to denuclearize. We are going to try to maintain our contacts and continue to stay in touch at high levels. And this was, by the way, before the president's letter was released and his decision was released. But the import of this statement was that the U.S. government to this date has not received a firm commitment from North Korea to denuclearize.
Evans Revere is senior director with the Albright-Stonebridge Group, and he was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman, all of that via Skype. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Italian President Sergio Mattarella has asked little-known lawyer and academic Giuseppe Conte to seek to form a new populist government that many migrants in Italy fear will mean deportation for them. Sabina Castelfranco reporting from Rome now that the prime minister-designate has begun to put together his cabinet.
Giuseppe Conte, a law professor with no political experience, was meeting Thursday with all the groups in Parliament to discuss his plans. Conte's name was put forward by Luigi Di Maio, leader of the Five Star Movement, which obtained the largest number of votes in the March general elections, and by Matteo Salvini, head of the second largest party, the League. The two parties have formed a coalition that will enable their government to have a majority in both houses of parliament.
Il Presidente della Repubblica mi ha conferito l'incarico di formare il governo.
After meeting with President Mattarella, Conte said he accepted with reservation the mandate to form a government. Conte added that if he managed to carry out this task, he would present a program to Parliament based on the interests of the majority political parties. Conte's list of government ministers is unlikely to be presented before late Friday. The cabinet lineup is still undergoing changes. The appointments of the heads of the two main parties appear certain. Five Star Movement leader Di Maio will head the Labour Ministry to enact his pledge to boost welfare for the poor. The League Salvini is to head the Interior Ministry to pursue his promised crackdown on illegal immigration.
Fuori da qui c'è un paese che giustamente attende la nascita di un esecutivo.
Conte was quick to declare that Italy is a country rightly awaiting the birth of a government and waiting for answers. He said the new government would be one of change. Change, however, comes with concern, especially in the immigrant community. Salvini, as interior minister, would be in charge of a crackdown on immigration that he has long professed.
L'immigrazione fuori controllo, oltre a riempire le galere,
Salvini has often said immigration that is out of control risks not only filling Italian jails, but also causing violent reactions which are never justified. He believes there is no question it is a phenomenon that must be controlled, and this could include deporting up to 500,000 illegal immigrants, a topic that was central to his electoral campaign. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Voters in the mostly Catholic Irish Republic are preparing to head to the polls today. A much-anticipated referendum on repealing a constitutional ban on all abortions except in the case where the mother's life is at risk. In 1983, the country outlawed abortion, although an exception was approved in 2013 to end a pregnancy when the life of the mother was deeply in jeopardy. Diarmaid Farriter is a lecturer in modern Irish history at the University College in Dublin. He tells VOA's Victor Beattie in 1983, two-thirds of the electorate voted for the ban.
But the amendment has caused endless debate and trouble because of the wording of the amendment giving equal right to the life of the mother and the unborn. That, in practice, has been very problematic. And we've been debating this issue now for a number of decades. And it's finally come to this, about whether or not the Constitution is the place for decisions about abortion, or whether it should belong to the political process through Parliament, through legislation, and to take it out of the Constitution altogether. So that's what's at stake on Friday, and the stakes are very high.
Why are they high?
They're high because this has been such a delicate, divisive, and emotive issue in Irish society for decades. There has been no shortage of absolutist declarations about abortion, as happens, of course, in other countries. But it's been particularly intense in Ireland because of Ireland's historic Catholic identity. The population of Southern Ireland, particularly after the creation of the two states of Ireland in almost 100 years ago, the population was over 90% Catholic. And many of our laws and constitutional provisions have reflected that Catholic identity. But there are those who maintain that it is no longer fit for purpose and doesn't correspond to the reality of a much more diverse and modern Ireland. So this is also debate, really, about the increasing secularisation of Ireland and whether Ireland can retain its distinctiveness in relation to the conservatism of its approach to abortion.
Has the Catholic Church played a big role in the campaigning?
The Catholic Church has not been as active or as vocal or as visible as it was in 1983. The people who are leading the campaign to retain the amendment are largely Catholic lay groups. A lot of senior church figures, though some individual bishops have been vocal, a lot of senior church figures have lost a lot of credibility in Ireland over the last couple of decades because of child abuse scandals, because of an increasing secularisation, and a belief that the Catholic Church in Ireland had far too much power for far too long. The Catholic Church is also not able to control the parameters of this debate to the extent that they have done historically, because it's not just being discussed now in the context of religion and morality. It's also being debated in the context of feminism, of healthcare, and of the need for Irish women's voices to be heard. The idea that this is no longer an abstract moral or religious or theological question, that it's actually rooted in the everyday experiences of Irish women and their pregnancies. And in that sense, we've had a very significant shift in public discourse about abortion, and it's being accepted, I think, as a much more complicated issue than it was presented historically.
Diarmaid Farriter also told VOA's Victor Beattie, Ireland's main political parties are backing repeal, but there is also what he called a well-organized anti-repeal campaign. He said abortion has been illegal since the 1860s, with the original penalty a conviction of murder. Subsequently, that was reduced to no more than 14 years in prison. Many Irish women wanting an abortion have had to travel to the United Kingdom, where abortion is legal. Recent opinion polls put the yes vote for repeal ahead, but those polls have since tightened a bit, with about 1 in 6 voters said to be undecided.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batty, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
A 102-year-old woman from New York who set a world record as a runner only 7 years ago has published a memoir documenting the achievements and tribulations of her challenging life. Ida Keeling's new published book is titled Can't Nothing Bring Me Down. VOA's Lotta Tsahok has more.
Ida Keeling began running in her late 60s. At the age of 95, she set the world record for her age group in the 60-meter race. She's also the first woman in history to complete a 100-meter run at the age of 100. Keeling's latest achievement is the book titled Can't Nothing Bring Me Down. What could have brought her down was the death of her 2 sons within a year from each other.
Well, after they passed away, I just couldn't get over both of them. So I just couldn't. I felt like I was going down. I'm already short. I'm getting shorter, I'm getting meaner, and I don't want to talk to nobody. Something went wrong, and I blamed myself.
Keeling says she took up running at her daughter's suggestion.
I went with this run, but while I was running, I was feeling my strength, and I was feeling like I was coming up out of a hole, and I just kept on going.
Despite arthritis in her fingers and knees, the 102-year-old starts every morning with stretching and some exercise, including push-ups. She encourages other people to stay physically active, regardless of age.
Get up and get around. Don't sit around doing nothing. Get up and do something. Sometimes you got things that, well, I don't like to do this. Get up and do it and get rid of it and look. See how different you feel. It's a big thing.
The number of people who live to be 100 is relatively small, but growing. The 2010 census recorded 53,000 centenarians living in the United States, 20,000 more than in 1980. Scientists say good genes are important, but that a healthy lifestyle and exercise contribute to longevity. Zlatica Tsahok, VOA News, Washington.
Drivers can choose from several GPS apps that can alert them to accidents or slow traffic so they can avoid them. But what about bike riders who travel the same roads as cars and are out there on their own? VOA's Faith Labadus tells us about an English student, a university student, who designed an app to help cyclists report the dangerous spots on the road to other cyclists and local governments.
It's called Flare, and it looks like an ordinary light you clip onto your handlebars. But Jake Thompson, a product design student at the University of Sussex, says the 3 buttons on its surface let cyclists report problems they encounter on roads the moment they see them.
Any of the data points that you can press are poor road surface, which covers potholes and broken road surfaces, and even glass on the roads, which you can specify after you drop the data point. The second one is road danger. So if you experience a close pass or a near miss and you feel a danger on the road, after you have experienced that, you can press that button to highlight that. And the last one is the junction danger. So hard to navigate or busy junction that's poorly designed that you want to flag up as a place for potential redesign.
Each click of a button sends the location of that problem to a phone app. After their ride, cyclists confirm their flares on the app and add comments. Their reports can be loaded onto a map. Thompson says that data can show local governments where to target funds for road repairs to give everyone a smoother ride. Thompson has been contacted by local authorities in California and Australia about setting up pilot schemes there for what he calls the first app-integrated smart bicycle light. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And still ahead on International Edition, the latest on the new World Cup theme. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Automated teller machines are nothing new, but a bank with robots greeting you at the door, that might be. State-owned China Construction Bank in Shanghai is exploring the fully automated bank. Their biggest advancement, face recognition technology. UTMU of the IU high-tech think tank. Traditional banks, he says, rely on their clerks to verify identities. But with facial recognition software, the error rate is very low. The bank also has virtual reality goggles allowing you to scour real estate investments. A curious visitor, Li Xiangqing, discovered the bank on a smartphone app and wanted to take a look. It seems, she says, like it's very convenient and capable, and the robot's language and technological abilities are very good, better than I imagined. Banks worldwide are doing similar things, but China's facial recognition technology, they say, sets them apart. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Well, the World Cup football tournament is set to kick off soon in Russia, and fans from all over the world will be watching, of course, in person, on TV, and online. And, of course, without one of the world's top sporting events, of course, always comes world-class entertainment. Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald shares with us and VOA's Jim Stevenson that Will Smith will be performing the official World Cup theme.
This is exciting news because one of the biggest multimedia stars on Earth, Will Smith, is aligning himself with the biggest sporting event on Earth, the World Cup. Mm-hmm. Will appear on the official song of the 2018 World Cup in Russia. You know, Will Smith has been largely absent from music since 2005. His first single in more than 10 years, Get Lit, appeared last October. Mm. It was a standalone song. And he hasn't given us an album since 2005. So for Will Smith to come back into the music world is an event. Will made the announcement Tuesday on Instagram. He tagged his collaborator Diplo, who will produce the song, along with reggaeton star Nicky Jam, who just picked up a Billboard Music Award last Sunday, and Kosovar singer Era Istrefi. Vibe magazine was the first to report Will Smith's involvement after a Puerto Rican producer named DJ Nelson let the info slip in an interview. Nicky Jam's manager Juan Diego Medina subsequently confirmed the news. He says that Nicky and Will finished recording the song last week in Budapest, and the song will get released on Friday, May 25th. The four artists are also believed to have shot the video for the song over the weekend. Past artists to include the official World Cup anthem include Ricky Martin, Anastasia, Pitbull, and Shakira, who did my favorite World Cup anthem, Waka Waka.
And those have all done very well.
They've all done very well. I mean, the World Cup is the World Cup. And anything associated with the World Cup is going to get international attention. The 2018 Football World Cup, for those of you who don't know, launches on June 14th in Moscow when host nation Russia plays Saudi Arabia. And the final will also take place in Moscow on July 15th. I love the pageantry of the World Cup, along with the excitement of the games. And I love Will Smith, too. I mean, the guy is just a great character. He's a great storyteller. I also happen to think he's a fantastic rapper, and I want to see if he still has any gas in his tank. So we'll find out on Friday.
As we've seen with previous World Cup musicians, they've performed live. I guess we can expect Will Smith will be performing live at some point.
I sure hope so.
We do too. Always performing each and every week, Ray McDonald and the VOA Top 20. You can hear it on VOA One. Also catch Ray on Facebook.
At VOA One The Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
It's going to be fun to hear Will Smith sing the song. Can't wait. It happens today. A couple of more stories for you. Priyanka Chopra, actress, goodwill ambassador for the United Nations Children's Agency, says the world should be more compassionate to the hundreds of thousands of Rohingya children who desperately needed help. They're in Bangladeshi camps where they've been sheltered. 700,000 of them had left Myanmar's Rakhine State last August. Lots of problems there. Went over to Bangladesh to seek help. UNICEF says many children crossed the border into Bangladesh without parents. Chopra visited the camps in Bangladesh bordering Myanmar, spent some time with the children at safe homes there and makeshift schools. She helped them draw pictures, she said, of sunshine and hope. Former U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama has a photo to share with everyone. She has unveiled the cover of her upcoming memoir, Becoming, posting the page, a smiling close-up shot of her, a portrait by photographer Miller Mobley on her Instagram account. She also said that on Instagram that, in her words, it was a meaningful and illuminating story, and she urged everyone to tell their own. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman. We're in Washington, hoping you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns the fraudulent election that took place in Venezuela on May 20th. This so-called election, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, is an attack on constitutional order and an affront to Venezuela's tradition of democracy. Until the Maduro regime restores a democratic path in Venezuela through free, fair, and transparent elections, the government faces isolation from the international community. The electoral process, said Mr. Pompeo, was choreographed by a regime too unpopular and afraid of its own people to risk free elections and open competition. It stacked the Venezuelan courts and National Electoral Council with biased members aligned with the regime. It silenced dissenting voices. It banned major opposition parties and leaders from participating. Human rights abuses remain a prominent feature of the Maduro regime. As of May 14th, some 338 political prisoners remain jailed, more than in all countries in the hemisphere combined. The regime stifled the free press and state sources dominated media coverage, unfairly favoring the incumbent. Most contemptible of all, said Secretary Pompeo, the regime selectively parceled out food to manipulate the votes of hungry Venezuelans. Indeed, most Venezuelans struggle to make ends meet as the economy remains in complete freefall, with the Bolivar Fuerte currency down 99% in the past year and inflation at an annual 14,000%, according to the National Assembly. Numerous countries in the hemisphere and throughout the international community condemned Venezuela's sham election. The Lima Group, made up of 14 countries throughout the Western Hemisphere, denounced the vote as failing to meet international standards of democratic, free, just, and transparent process. The group, which includes Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia, announced their intention to reduce their level of diplomatic relations with Venezuela and encourage international and regional organizations to not issue Venezuela additional credit that could be used by the regime to further oppress the Venezuelan people. The United States, said Secretary Pompeo, stands with democratic nations in support of the Venezuelan people and will take swift economic and diplomatic actions to support the restoration of their democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.